Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
And today, we are talking about fully automated luxury communism. And you might be familiar with the concept from memes. And I have recently been informed that it's not just a meme. So I read a bunch of stuff about it, and now we're going to talk about why it's not just a meme. And whether or not we should grapple with this concept seriously. Okay, so Aaron Bastani didn't invent fully automated luxury communism, but he certainly has played a primary role in popularizing it with the book that he wrote that came out on Verso. And it seems to have stirred up a lot of controversy, and it seems to be inspiring a lot of people. And I think that the way that he presents the concept is probably the most popular in discourse on the left.
I think probably so. I'm less familiar with Inventing the Future by Nick Cernicek and Alex Williams, but I think it predates the Bastani book.
Wait, what? The Demand Full Automation Now book or whatever? Yeah, that book is really incredibly uninspiring. The entire thing is just an argument that social democracy hasn't fulfilled its promise, and neoliberalism has created a hellscape. Technology is gonna save everything, but we have to envision, you know, a fully liberated society in order for it to come into existence. So I'm now going to take this whole book to, like, talk about what a great vision that is. And that's the book.
Okay, so Bastani's version has a lot more meat to it than that. He seems to have, like, some sort of program. It's a manifesto for fully automated luxury communism, and I think it would be a very good initiatory text to give to someone who's like, well, you know, I agree with you guys, but how do we get, like, what kind of future are you talking about? That being said, I think it falls short in a lot of places. I think it still is mired in the muck of late capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, Bastani talks about drawing on Marx and about the promise of a society, of a new mode of production, which is, you know, as much machine-driven as possible, and that the necessity of human labor is reduced to its minimum, and that there's more human output with less time, right? So that time is won back for people, and that the whole notion of career wage workers is abolished and all of the rest of it. But then he also marries it with really contemporary techno-utopian notions of what our technology will do. It's probably worth us talking a little bit about the, broadly speaking, what the vision of fully automated luxury communism is.
Yes.
And then we should
absolutely
talk about, you know, whatever the rest of it. Because back whenever it was, when I thought it was just a meme, I didn't think about it any more than that. I was like, oh yeah, that's funny. Like, yeah, after the revolution, like, you just, the work will do itself, and hamburgers will deliver themselves to your house while you play video games. And it turns out that is actually a lot of what the vision is too.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, whenever I was unemployed, or underemployed, how about that? I sat at home and read books and, you know, worked on the podcast a lot, and it didn't feel very fulfilling just because I knew that I was just kind of spinning my wheels. You know, I'm making a podcast, and there's a very small group of people listen to it, and I'm very happy that they do. But it didn't seem like that's, I should spend, you know, 8 hours of my day, you know, 7 days a week coming up with this kind of pretty okay podcast. You know what I mean? So I was thinking, you know, imagine living in a fully automated society where I didn't have to work. What am I going to do? Make a podcast about how everything's pretty cool? and read books about what? How we don't really need to change society because everything's pretty cool? I don't know. I can't. Maybe I can't break out of my capitalist mode of thinking, you know?
Yeah, that's capitalist realism right there.
It is capitalist realism. I can't imagine a world in where I'm not fucking angry about shit and needing to shout about it, you know? Or at least not depressed about everything and wanting to like mope about it. Those are my two modes, angry and yelling and sad and moping.
Well, history will always have happened, so you can always be angry about that.
That's true.
That's true, yeah.
No, I mean, I so but like...
robots will be teaching people, so I'll just be like learning history to, you know, just to know it. And all the fucking teaching will be automated.
I mean, that actually gets at my my first criticism of the notion of a fully automated society is I recognize that typically when a person says like a fully automated society, that they don't necessarily literally mean fully automated to that every single productive function that you can conceive of, including the really specific like specific to a person kind of work that comes with mentoring and child rearing and, you know, it's plenty of stuff that's drudgery under this society, but it's really difficult to imagine an algorithm or even a hyper intelligent, you know, piece of machinery and software able to do it. But some of these things are about, I think if we followed it to its logical conclusion, we would be presented with a huge problem, which is that the innate creativity of human beings comes from labor. And from, you know, trying to resolve problems of a physical nature. And so I don't really know what kind of a society is being envisioned in which human beings are so freed up that I guess they don't have to solve problems anymore. It just makes me wonder what we think will drive the species forward in terms of development at an intellectual level.
We're thinking of like a WALL-E society, you know?
It's a distinct possibility.
Everyone's just like floating around on their like hovercraft with TVs on it. They don't have to think. They just like drink giant sodas and like float around over the you know,
piles of
the
trash,
corridors of their spaceship.
Yeah.
Or Star Trek, where, you know, everything's cool on Earth, but there's still some fucking crazy bad guys outside of Earth. that's where our human ingenuity.
Yeah.
Solving conflicts with somehow advanced species that are still mired in like feudal modes of production but have starships like the Klingons, you know?
Yeah, we would probably colonize them. Let's talk about what's actually appealing and motivating about it first. I think that might give us a slightly better platform.
Yeah.
From which to go to grow out of.
Well, I think it at least shows that there are some people trying to have an imagination, because I think a few things. One of the talking points that we fall back on is not feeling the need to imagine what a future socialist society or communist society could look like, because we like to fall back on not feeling like we need to have a blueprint. And while, you know, I guess to whatever extent I agree that we don't need to have a blueprint, it's nice to have mm-hmm. some ideas, you know, and it's nice to not, it's not just nice. It's
pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. No, I mean, I actually think it's important that we are imagining a future, right? And I obviously am not coming the perspective of someone who is overwhelmingly optimistic about that future, but I do think we have to be able to win people over, and winning people over with just like this utilitarian vision of like people's roles as workers and romanticizing people's roles as workers, and actually having a conversation about work and what that looks like, other than like, oh, well, you get to survive and also have a lovely life under communism. Like imagining those things and having a larger conversation about reimagining work or like the abolition of work or those are things that actually really inspire me.
Yeah, I do think it on those terms, I think there's something positive about articulating a vision of the future in which one that's not dystopian, it's not Mad Max, and it's not, you know, yeah, the Matrix or whatever, but it is a vision of the future which is positive and aspirational in a certain sense. I mean, I could definitely see the appeal of the notion that technological developments are already such that we could begin moving in the direction of a society in one day in which the drudgeries of work, which everyone hates, that's gone. And that, you know, at least in the Bastani book, there's the attempt to resolve the question of natural resources and sustainability. But talking about space exploration and like mining asteroids, that's one of his big fixes, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not it's not completely in defiance of genuine concerns about, you know, ecological sustainability or whatever. I do have issues with the way that a lot of it's raised, but I think in the first case, I think that there's something good about trying to articulate a vision of the future.
I think a major problem that we've had since, I don't know, since it became necessary for Marxists to defend actually existing socialism, right? It then, like, henceforth and eternally, we lost our communist horizon. It became, you know, like, well, there's this shitty thing over here, but, you know, it's better than capitalism. And, you know, yeah, they did some bad stuff, but, you know, we just have to, like, be hard-headed realists about this sort of thing. And, you know, like, you know, what's your proposed alternative, et cetera, whatever. So it's all sort of about, like, pragmatic, like, looking at the hard realities of the world and justifying the negative things that we steps that we have to undertake and that sort of thing, losing the real the narrative, the story, the myth that human beings need to propel us as agents operating the world. We need these things that propel us, that motivate us on an individual, psychological, human level. So I think that it's good for returning to the communist horizon. I think it also is intervening in a much more mainstream discourse that already exists out in the world that is about the rapid advance of computer technology, so-called artificial intelligence that is increasingly automating certain types of jobs that previously we thought were not automatable, which many mainstream political actors, political theorists, economists, that sort of thing, openly sort of worry about the problem, the quote-unquote problem of eliminate, you know, mass unemployment that could come from sudden rapid automation of all kinds of new work. And he's sort of intervening in that conversation with a full-throated defense of that's a good thing if we don't have to work. The future could be different. And I think that's, you know, that's good. It's compelling and it's important to have that intervention being part of the conversation.
So, yeah, I don't think that I have the intellectual chops or a good enough understanding of science to speak from any position of authority. But I guess because of my history, my instinctive response is to think that like this conversation is centering something that feels very utopian and feels impossible. And I feel like after reading and listening, less so like that. I mean, I still feel that tugging me at my core, very much so. But I think it's at least a very cool starting point that feels more realistic than I had previously thought. I think what really interests me is I think a lot of times we fall back on what is natural for humans. And we've done that a lot when talking about like the nuclear family or sexuality. And I've never really been a fan of talking about what's natural. And we do that a lot when we talk about like food science and stuff like that too. And I think this conversation really opens that argument wide open. That like, are we trying to go back to what is natural? Are we really striving for like a return to primitive communism? And I don't think so, and I don't hope so. And I think centering what's natural in a lot of our arguments is shitty Marxism and not useful. And this conversation inspires me a lot more. So yeah, I think a lot of what they had to say about like food science is really interesting in terms of like talking about like GMOs and like not needing to consume so much meat and things like that. That's really interesting to me. And I want to hear what other people have to say about that.
So to me, the parts of it that I found to be interesting were not space communism parts so much as the idea of having massive programs for planting trees and rewilding and using food science to engineer different ways of people to consume protein that don't involve factory farming.
Yeah.
So, you know, growing meats or using, you know, plant-based meats or whatever, because animal agriculture is completely unsustainable. And if everyone wanted to eat the way Americans eat, then like the way that the book is advocating, they should be able to. And then we're going to need something other than, you know, animals to be able to feed them, which as a general rule, I think is probably a good idea that we don't kill animals to eat them. And if we could figure out a way to do that if science could figure out a way to produce necessary proteins in a way that isn't destructive to the environment or to animals in general, then yeah, I think that's great. I think that's something that I have always advocated for as a socialist. And even before I was a socialist, I was a vegan, you know, so whatever. The things that I find to be positive were like the rewilding and the
lab-grown meat.
Advanced food science, you know, trying to find new ways to be able to deliver meat or meat-like substances to people that don't require factory farming and, you know, mass slaughter of animals and dumping their waste into rivers and shit like that. Yeah, that's all great. That's all stuff that I like. But I kind of see, I don't know. I don't know if we want to get into the parts that we don't like about it yet. So,
I mean, I think there's sort of an artificial division there because even though I think it's positive to be trying to articulate a vision of the future, I mean, I don't think this is the one that I think we should be articulating. I think it's good because it gives us a point of discussion about what kind of world we want to look, what kind of world we want to live in, which is not about referencing the New Deal or referencing a vision of the future, which is not a reimposing of a past experience like the New Deal or, you know, Swedish social democracy or of 1917. Like, I think that it's good to be in a place of debating, like, what kind of future do we want to build? Which, you know,
yeah,
which hopefully we can put new stuff in that isn't just the best things we've done in the past, but better somehow. Because that's, yeah, we've talked about that a lot, how that's not particularly inspiring, even for those of us who kind of purport to be inspired by it. But on the other hand, I do really feel like it doesn't articulate a vision of the future that is dramatically different from that which is standard in liberalism right now. I mean, it takes the desire for a society without class and marries it to fairly standard techno-utopian visions of the future that, you know, somebody like Elon Musk, you know, your average libertarian might have in terms of a really like almost a belief in the almost supernatural power of technology like that. And Bastani even says like that he's not a revolutionary. He's not seeking a point of rupture that is, you know, from human hands or human activity. He refers to automation as a disruption, similar to the development of agriculture or the steam engine, which basically sets the stage. And then he even says he envisions a whole transitional period where we arrive at, you know, the fully automated luxury communism of the future. But then he also has a political program. So I think it's a little unclear for a reason, because it tries to envision a very far distant future, but really just in terms which are like incredibly contemporary. And I think that the problem with that is, on the one hand, it doesn't really address, I think, something which is much more fundamental to the communist project, which to me is more about freedom and the emancipation of our species being, right? All the stuff that comes from oppression and exploitation. And luxury, to me, is something that should take a backseat. So it sort of argues you don't have to give up anything, but also you could have more. And that might be true in the long run. But in the immediate sense, like, it might not be true. And I would rather be trying to motivate a vision for people that, you know, that's about power and about freedom. And maybe we can construct a world which is somehow sustainable at some point, which also is something like Bastani's vision.
That Four Futures, Life After Capitalism episode by General Intellect Unit that talks about the book.
Yeah.
I thought, and we're going to link that in the show notes because it's great, and that's an awesome podcast. And if you're into technology and Marxism, then you should listen to General Intellect Unit. But they talk about the four likely futures. You know, four, not the four likely, they talk about four likely futures. And one of them is this sort of like a fully automated luxury communism idea. And the other one is a sort of late stages of ecological collapse, vision of socialism as managed scarcity and reclamation, which to me is the version of the future that I think I find most inspiring.
Yeah.
Because I can't, fully automated luxury space communism just to me sounds like a silly meme, even though I read all this stuff about it. And I know that there's a lot of parts of it sound appealing to me. To me, that sounds like pie in the sky when you die. It might as well just be talking about going to heaven. I think that what we've got to deal with now is we have to figure out a way to stop what has been deemed irreversible climate change. And that is going to take, probably in the short term, some sort of moratorium on developing new technologies that are not sustainable. And I don't know how we get to full automation if we stop mining the things that are destroying the planet. Because we have to stop producing the things that are destroying the planet. We don't have time for full automation to just develop. And like we talked about in the Future Has Been Canceled episode, automation isn't developing at the rate that people seem to think it is.
Yeah. Right. Like, I mean, no technology is.
Yeah. We're stuck in the modern day plantation system where we've got so many low paid wage workers doing stuff that should be automated, but that it is at currently too expensive to automate, so there's no motivation to automate it. It's like slaves in the Latifundia in the Roman Empire stymied technological production because labor was just so cheap. And that's sort of what we got now in the global south, and increasingly more and more so on a daily basis in the global north as well. Labor is too cheap to innovate automation in the way that would be necessary for it to have developed in the near future in time to save the planet or whatever, you know. I think that the vision of this socialism as managed scarcity and reclamation of devastation of devastated landscape is probably the future that we're going to have to look forward to. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, that has been a running theme in a lot of the episodes that we've done, I think, for a reason. I'm pretty clearly of two minds about this, because I do think that something about what this kind of what this sort of school of thought envisions is something about it is realizable and desirable, but a lot of it isn't. And so, like, I don't know where I get the I have a desire to give it some kind of credence first, because mm-hmm. most of what I have to say is more along the lines of a fairly harsh critique. And it has to do with, you know, I think on the one hand, the one that comes to mind most easily, yeah, is the one that is yours, Chris. It's the one about sustainability in production and consumption and circulation of goods, and what the actual ruptural moment probably looks like, and what the transitional form of society actually probably looks like.
Yeah.
And so I think in a lot of ways it's disarming in that it seems to advocate. It seems to propose that the transition ought to be relatively comfortable, and it does seem to flow from a certain position that one might have in the world. That, at the risk of sounding like a third worldist, I don't think everybody in the world gets to assume that the transition won't be comfortable, and probably doesn't even care either, right? So it's highly optimistic, but it's at its core, I think it's a fairly low horizon. Because it seems right. to define, yeah, because it's rooted in the meeting of needs and desires, but it doesn't really even take up any concerns about what manufactures our needs and desires in the first place. It's a politics for the fulfillment of desires created by capitalism that capitalism can't fulfill.
Right,
it's
exactly.
It's not a politics of dignity and self-actualization and freedom and the liberation of desire, right? The redefinition of what it is that a human being needs to feel completed at their core, even at the expense of comfort and luxury. So in some ways, it's almost the antithesis to the politics that I espouse.
One of the things that came to mind when thinking about this episode is the idea that we can all, everyone in the world, can stream whatever communist Netflix is 24/7 on their, you know, 74-inch flat screen OLED TVs whenever they want, and can cast from their phones to their TVs to share whatever it is that they're looking at the time so all their friends can see. And, you know, we can all live in this futuristic, you know, techno paradise. And it made me think of the Kristen Godsey book we read about interactions in the Eastern Bloc between people that didn't really have anything to do. Like they would get off of work, and, you know, they're living relatively comfortable lives because they've got all of their needs taken care of, and they didn't have TVs, they didn't have like a lot of entertainment, so they all hung out together, and they talk about the friendships that were formed and the way that they interacted with their community. And the way that they got to know everybody in their building, and the way they would have like gatherings in their neighborhoods just to kill time and hang out together. And a lot of people spent time outside walking after dinner and spent time together in parks. And I'm like, well, I don't, not to sound reactionary, but I want that right. and not streaming communist Netflix 24/7, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want full automation and luxury mm-hmm. of that sort. I want a different kind of luxury, a luxury that comes from leisure time and freedom from want. That to me is a luxury that I'll never have in this lifetime, you know?
Yeah, and I'm trying really hard to not throw out bad faith criticisms, which is why I was so hesitant and I use so many qualifiers when saying, like, instinctively I feel like this meme and idea or whatever is utopian. But I think another thing that really tugs at me is not far off from what you're getting at, Chris, which is that, like, as an educator, like, I'm very invested in this idea of ontological vocation, right? So, like, the idea that the education, without like going too far into it, like that essentially education can't and shouldn't be automated, right? I don't believe.
Oh, hell yeah. Absolutely.
I feel like that's very harmful, not just physically because I teach dance, right? But just in general, right? Because you can automate training. It's being automated already via like YouTube channels and things like that, increasingly. But you can't automate creativity, right? At any rate, to go back.
Oh, they're trying.
I know. To go back to what I was initially saying, which is that like education should be, in part at least, informative and also something that helps us realize and helps students realize and learners realize that which makes us feel the most human and that which makes us feel the most purposeful. And I know that I have the luxury of working in a field that I feel very passionately about, that and enables me to be creative, even if it's in ways that are like very creatively exhausting. Last year, I choreographed like 30 different solos, duos, and trios, plus about like 30 more group numbers. That might not mean anything to listeners or you all, but whatever.
I didn't even do one, so I'm impressed.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm pumping out creativity and productivity, and it's exhausting, and I'm not super proud of all of it, whatever. But that is to say, like, I do know that, like, I speak from a very I guess unique position in that sense, that I'm like incredibly invested in the work I do. I want to do this after the revolution and during full luxury communism or whatever other future there is, you know. And it's really important to me that like we don't lose sight of that. And I, like I said, I'm trying to not have a bad faith critique of this future society that folks are envisioning, but I'm struggling to figure out how my role fits into that. And I also am trying to not, I guess for so long, I very much attach myself to my role as a worker and as someone who I believe I'm very productive. I don't know. It's just hard to envision how art and education and my like existing in the center of a Venn diagram of those things, where that fits in this future society.
You sound like a Luddite.
Obviously, I'm not building an argument that like communism doesn't allow for like the flourishing of arts, and is it doesn't create an overall better way of approaching education and more liberatory way of approaching education and pedagogy, right? I certainly believe those things to be true, and I think history proves that that is the case. I just think with this particular vision of communism, maybe that's my own, the limitations of my own imagination, but I'm struggling.
I agree. I think that I'm like, am I just unable to imagine a technological future that isn't just shitty? Mm-hmm. Because the terms in which it's couched are ones that I'm very familiar with now. And they're like everything I fucking hate about technology. Mm-hmm. Yeah, except for it'll be good because it's communism.
Yeah.
Well, right. Well, I mean, he's conjuring a vision of the future based on the potentialities of technology as they are currently presented to us in our world and society. I think it's the
right, conf. Right.
It's,
I get that.
It's well, it's the limitations of the whole the framework in which he's engaging with it, which is one of the virtues I identified at the outset was that he's intervening in an existing conversation about the nature and direction of technologies. And I think that there are criticisms that could go like it could be fundamentally broken down into two camps. One of the criticisms could be that this isn't actually actually going to happen. These are the, you know, the projections of tech entrepreneurs who are trying to sell their businesses to, you know, venture capital in order to get funding for their enterprises, right? Their utopian visions of artificial intelligence eliminating work and et cetera, it's all this like crazy shit like that is it's, you know, it's a shell game, you know, it's cheap sort of street trick, magic tricks, you know, that are there is no magical sort of other side of the rainbow that we're about to like pop out of, and so this vision of the future that we're being called upon to go toward isn't really there to leap into. That's one camp of the critiques. The other camp, I think, is the, well, even if this were coming down the road, I don't think that this is even desirable. I think, however, I mean, I think there are some, there's a lot more to be said about both of those things. But I think that one could take the vision laid out in this book of a techno-utopian future based on the possibilities that could, but not necessarily will, come into existence, like lab-grown meat and mining stuff from asteroid belts to be able to set up solar panels all over the place and have infinite, you know, infinite sustainable energy that's not being mined out of the earth itself, and hence not destroying the earth, you know, et cetera, so on and so forth. These things are like he's setting up a picture of the world wherein scarce technology has relieved humanity of the problem of material scarcity. And then I think he's leaving it to the an unanswered question of what do we do with a world that is relieved of material scarcity, and not necessarily saying that it has to be, you know, the Wall-E world or whatever it is,
right.
But rather that, you know, we don't have to motivate people to go to work through, you know, withholding food and shelter and the necessities of life if they don't show up to work and do a good job and are disciplined by their boss or whatever like that, because there is no need to make humans economically productive. We don't have to do that if there is no real material scarcity that's been eliminated by technology. I think that's, you know, it's actually a pretty rudimentary proposition, rudimentary communist proposition that socialists have been saying since before Marx. I think there might, though, be even maybe a third critique of what he's saying, a third camp of critique to what he's saying. That is, I'm not positive. Maybe I don't want to do a bad faith reading and sort of read a negative thing into what he's saying and then, you know, critique the thing that I just read into it. But I think he is proposing that technology is sort of the amount and rapidity and nature of the development of technology that is currently coming into existence or foreseeably will come into existence introduces a new contradiction into capitalism that says, like,
no, that's exactly right, what he's saying.
Yeah, that's not a bad faith reading. That's a, okay. That's very
okay,
much
good.
Like it's primary, yeah.
Okay, good. I'm glad to know that I'm not.
He talks about a change in the fundamental change to the base, altering the superstructure, and that automation is a fundamental change that sort of pushes us in the direction of automated luxury communism. That's not inevitable, he says, but that it pushes us forward towards that goal. And to me, that's a problem for two reasons. One that I already mentioned, that it's not likely going to happen before we destroy the whole fucking planet.
It's a big one.
That's a pretty fucking big one, yeah.
And second, I don't want automation.
I
definitely think that there is value to the old Marxian idea that we're going to automate away. I mean, not even just old Marxian. Kevin mentioned also that it goes back to before Marx. We're going to automate away the terrible jobs as much as we possibly can. But there is a certain amount of human contact that is necessary to do a lot of jobs. And I think that one of the articles that we read, which will go up in the show notes, that I don't really remember who wrote it or which publication it appeared. I think it might have been the LibCom article. Jason, do you remember who wrote that?
MCM to CMC. Money, commodity, monody.
Okay.
Commodity, money, commodity.
Oh, okay, good. No, okay, so that article points out something. You know, the raising of children and the care of the elderly and the care of the sick requires a human touch. You cannot automate elder care. Imagine something more alienating than being alone when all your children are, you know, you have no children, say, you're dead, you know, who comes, you're not dead. You're close to dying.
You got to really consider how it feels when you're dead, you know?
Okay, so the elderly being left alone is a real fucking problem, yeah. Right? And imagine if you didn't even have the nurses that come in to care for you, but you had fucking robots instead, right? I mean, to me, that just sounds like a dystopia, not some sort of like luxury.
Well,
and maybe that's the limits of my imagination at this point. That might be the limits of my imagination, or it might be the limits of the way that this is being presented to us. Because I think that caring for people doesn't have to be the drudgery that it is. Maybe we automate away the gross parts of caring for people, but leave in the human contact, you know? But to me, I think that that might be a lack of imagination on my part, and there might be so much more room for interpretation. But I think that jobs are going to have to exist, and some of those jobs are going to be caring for people or interacting with people. And I think in a world where we give meaning to work that is more than just earn or die, then work ceases to be drudgery and it becomes something that you do for the betterment of society and for the benefit of, you know, humankind, you know, or the fucking, for the cause, for the building the utopian future. And I don't think work has to be something that needs to be automated away.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about problems of transition and what sorts of things I think we ought to be like really popularizing in the workers' movement, they have a lot more to do with state ownership and self-management and, you know, yeah, eliminating drudgery and opening up opportunities for fulfillment and greater democratization and disalienation. And the stuff about fully automated luxury communism, I don't think it's a failure of imagination on your part so much as I think it's that your imagination is directed at making life more meaningful and livable under the conditions based on what it is that you've experienced in your own life, rather than making it more luxurious based on what you know of luxury.
Yeah.
Like, I really think my biggest issue with this is that it's not that it's necessarily inconceivable. It's not that it's really far in the future. It's that it suffers from a kind of a lack of imagination about, I think, much more profound questions than moving from scarcity to comfort to luxury. There's a book that I've been reading called The New Dark Age by James Bridle, and one of the things that he refers to is the end game of enlightenment, where he refers mm-hmm. to the kind of the gathering and distribution. The gathering and distribution of information and data about everything that can possibly exist has led in no way to a qualitative leap in our humanity. Like,
yeah,
despite the fact that the algorithms are actually fairly dumb and way worse at utilizing information than human beings are, it also it hasn't in any way tended us in a direction that even opens up a door for what we might think of as emancipation. The ruptural moment, you know, the politics of class struggle, of human beings entering the stage of history in order to combat the horrifying alienation in their lives and identifying it with the regime, the capitalist regime of subordination of labor to profit. That's deeply meaningful at the level of what we might call humanism. The other stuff to me is extra. And that's the issue I keep coming back to, is it seems to really have priorities flipped upside down. It's a communism for people who are techno-utopians, but it doesn't challenge the faith in technology and productivism that we have at the core of our existing society. So, you know, it doesn't speak to my romantic side that desires the re-enchantment of the world and thinks of emancipation in terms of the return of adventure and exploration, mm-hmm. and of really the opposite of what I think a fully automated luxury society would provide me. So maybe it's, I don't know if it's a lack of imagination. Maybe it's as simple as whatever our priorities are. But this is not mine.
So I think that might sort of like intersect with what I think though the real. The third option for avenue for critiquing this this idea or this book or this idea that I was mentioning just a minute ago it being that he's saying technology is creating a new contradiction, and I think that misunderstands how capitalism functions. Like there isn't, like right now, the problem is not material scarcity. We don't have to wait until new technologies right. are invented to be able to eliminate material scarcity. Material scarcity doesn't exist. There are more empty homes than there are homeless people. There is more food produced in the world and then thrown out every day than every single mouth on the planet needs to eat. It's the sole obstacle is allocation of resources. It's not allocation, distribution, control of resources, not whether there is enough actual material sustenance or energy or whatever. That problem has already been solved.
From the time I started studying anthropology, it was through a Marxist lens. And the Marxist anthropology tends to uncritically accept the idea that labor led to the evolution of modern right. man. It was the necessity of our most recent generations of ancestors to abstractly conceive of and then create that led to the evolution of the brain that anatomically modern humans have now that allowed for human beings to be what they are. The intelligence that we have was evolved as a result of necessity, as a result of labor, right? So to me, if everything has been automated away, that is just a different kind of alienation from what it is that mm-hmm. makes us human. You know, if we've got no necessity to ever conceive of and create because everything is automated, then what we're doing is just creating a new kind of alienation. We're alienated from our labor now by being forced to produce without creativity. Or when we are able to be creative, we're not able to realize the fruits of our creative labors. This just sounds like an alienation of lack of necessity to create or be creative, and thus a lack of need to labor and just indolence. But to me, that's what I think is the end result of full automation is indolence. And a degeneration right. of what it is that makes us human. I know that people are going to have like leisure time and going to be able to create all kinds of things just because they want to create. But I think that necessity yeah. is important in this equation. And I also don't think it's possible. But that's just another thing. Even if it was possible, it's not desirable.
Right. Well, and that's isn't the point of you. The point to of me, utopia. If every utopian notion is to chart a path, at least in the minds of the oppressed, out of their present condition and towards something that is, whether it's immediately achievable or even fully achievable or not, that it drives people in the direction of fighting their present conditions and trying to make them better. And I think we have a real problem articulating just what we mean by alienation and why we think it's so central to the human experience under specifically the profit system, right, of the rule of capital. You know, like, we can quibble a lot about the specifics of whether or not a person like Federici has the history right all the time. But I think that there's enough in what pre-capitalist societies, however horrifying and oppressive they might be, that there's enough in them to preserve in terms of our liberation from machines. You know, the life before machines is a very desirable one in a lot of ways, which is not to say that we should try to turn the clock back, but I don't think that we ought to, like, double down on the domination of machines. I think we ought to consider actually that there's something very elemental. And so a utopia that doesn't put that sort of that whatever it is that, you know, in religions you call the soul, and whatever else, that, you know, that thing that makes us human that is alienated by a society dominated by machines, if we don't put that at the center of our utopia, I do sort of fear for what sort of society we actually do build, what sort of a movement we actually do build that doesn't have disalienation at its core above all other concerns. So it's, to me, it's at the deepest level, it's what kind of a movement is oriented in this direction that that gives me concern when we think about the function, the political utility of a given utopian vision.
Yeah. How do I phrase this ever? Okay. So I think a lot of times when we're having these sorts of conversations about envisioning a communist future, both within this context and others, but especially within this one, right? We think about automating the necessities, right? Which is like production, like food, goods, whatever, and necessities like housing and healthcare. We're talking about automating those. Okay. And I know I'm just going to beat this dead ass horse, but we're envisioning a society in which these things are automated. And, you know, I know, I guess what we always say is that, like, this leaves people a lot of leisure time to be creative and to pursue art or further education or whatever else. And that feels like not actually prioritizing those things and not viewing those things as, like, productive or necessary. And I do actually think that's fucking harmful and shitty and scary, and I don't want to be a part of it. I don't know how to complete my thought, and I don't want to ramble on.
That's what I was doing, was rambling.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I mean, that's what our podcast is, but I'm really struggling to...
This has proven to be kind of a little bit of a tough topic. Partially because I think part of the difficulty of it is, like, the whole thing... It's hard for me to wrap my brain around why this is revelatory for people or something. Like, the idea of fully automated luxury... oh, you mean communism? Like, why all the addendums? Like, you're literally just talking about a, you know, resource... where every, you know, from each according to their ability to each according to their need. That's what you're describing. Just like, now we have computers, you know, like.
Well, it's specifically the notion of post-work, you know, it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, work sucks.
A society where everyone gets what they need. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. Work does suck. I don't want to work. So, like, look, if I had all of my needs taken care of, if I had universal you know, universal basic services plus a universal basic income so that I had spending money on top of all of my material needs, necessities taken care of so that I could go out and like purchase, you know, nice things that I wanted as it came along or whatever. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't be Wally, one of the people in the Wally world, riding around on a floating device watching communist Netflix all the time. I would probably do that sometimes, but
I think you, I bet you would.
But, you know, I would be able to pursue creative endeavors. I could smoke weed more, I can't dance. Jenny tried to teach me how to dance one time and it did not go well. You know, if that were more my forte, I could focus on just spending all of my time, sharing, you know, this artistic endeavor. But not only I would be able to do that, but, like everyone would be able to sort of develop themselves as fuller, more robust human beings with the capacities, the full creative and artistic capacities that each of us bring to the world. Caring for each other, being artistic and creative, and that, like, develops, you know, so Jenny teaches dance now, right, while she struggles to get by and, like, keep food on the table and pay rent and all this kind of stuff, but, like, if she lived in a world where, like, everyone was able to act, where she didn't have to worry about material scarcity and everyone was engaging in their various different artistic creative endeavors, that that would edify her experience of engaging in the world of dance or whatever, because there's so much more creativity being put out into the world that you Jenny are able to interact with. And I don't know, I think it would also there's got to be aspects of your job that are like inhibiting that could be liberated or freed up. But sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's still working. Yeah. Teaching dance is still work. Sometimes you're going to have shithead students that, like, need to be taught, right? So if you're just like, well, I'm doing this for art and fuck you, go away, you know, then the shithead student that really could have used, like, a little bit of understanding to be able to learn something and could eventually just get over it. Yeah, that never happens because, you know, this is just for art, you know, fuck you.
Yeah.
I did not think that through. It just kind of came out. But it's something that occurred to me. It's like, maybe you go to it voluntarily, and maybe you don't have to do it in order to live, but it's still work, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, and I guess that's why I struggle so much with, like, the post-work vocabulary and vision, is because even though I hate the conditions under which I perform my labor, I love what I do, even. And it's not just that I love what I do, is that I love contributing something to my kiddos and to the world. I think that's why, part of why I have such a hard time with this vocabulary and this idea is because maybe we don't have to call it work after, but I just don't think there's something inherently wrong. And I think it's actually desirable to want to contribute something to people and to the world.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of feel like stuck here because I don't think that anything that anybody just said was wrong. And the only thing I have is something I've already said, which is that I think, to me, it's more about the political utility of advocating a vision of the future based on post-work, rather than the political utility of a vision of the future based on freedom, like based on disalienation, right, which is to say, a UBI is a version of post-work for a segment of society, right? The Iron Heel is a distinct actual possibility for the future that would make, maybe even a post-capitalist future, but still based on the exploitation of highly skilled labor and then surplus populations, which you may or may not decide to just, you know, have a holocaust to get rid of. You could always just buy them off with the UBI for a while. And that's a dystopian vision that's absurd in a lot of ways, but sometimes you pursue a line of logic to its furthest conclusion to find what in it does or doesn't speak to you. And
that's the Elysium.
Yeah.
Well, that's Jack London's that's Jack London's The Iron Heel. We're talking about 120 years ago of a vision of a kind of post-capitalist society, which is post-work for a huge amount of the population, but they live in squalor, and a UBI could even be conceivably one which is you live in luxury. And since we're spitballing here, you can buy off a segment of a movement which is motivated primarily by post-work with the UBI. But you can't buy off a movement which is motivated by, I want to feel human by eliminating the barriers between me and my other fellow human beings, right? I want community. I want, the things which are less tangible at the moment because capitalism has given a society of drudgery and luxury and the binary between the two and the desire to escape drudgery with luxury. So it's not that fully automated luxury communism is an inconceivable or undesirable future. It's that it's not a slogan for a movement to like thrash against what the present society has to offer with the kind of, ghetto fighters' grim defiance that I think might be necessary to give it a fighting chance. My problem is with its political utility, more than anything else.
There was a part of the book, or a part of his argument, that I liked, and that he says that there needs to be a redefining of what luxury means as well. And he pointed to the clubs for working people and swimming pools for working people in 1920s Britain and in Sweden, where things that would be considered opulent by the standards of the time were paid for by taxes on the rich at the time, and how we can think of sort of communal spaces providing things that would be considered opulent now. Like, I guess he mentions like infinity pools and stuff like that, being provided by the state, by the collective. And I think that is a concept worth developing, is redefining what we mean by luxury. Because if luxury is just all the things that the wealthiest, not the wealthiest, but that wealthy Americans can afford extended to everyone, then I don't have any interest in that conception of a future, because I think that, I think that that's produced a society that I don't want to have anything to do with.
Yeah.
Even sure. If it is a communist one. But if we are redefining luxury as giving access to wonderful things to people as a community, such as the things that I mentioned previously, then that's something that I'm willing to talk about,
So I think of the things that I do when I'm feeling luxurious, right? And I really struggle to see how those things can be automated, because what I think of is like getting facials, and that shit does not slap. And I guess if it's automated, and I guess again, maybe all of this is just a matter of the shortcomings and limitations of my own imagination, but a robot delivering my facial and sucking out all my blackheads and hydrating my face. Like, I there's something different about the human interaction of someone and their knowledge and their skills that they have developed to be able to have me walk out of there feeling like I have a brand new face. And, the other thing is, which it shouldn't be considered luxurious given the line of work that I'm in. I used to get massages once or twice a month. Just, it's a matter of maintenance for the field that I work in. At any rate, it is something many people think is very luxurious and not healthcare, right? The idea, okay, so the idea of like sitting in a massage chair, that is not going to relieve the tension in my traps or deal with my number of existing injuries that I have acquired as a result of the line of work that I'm in, right? The human interaction and human labor is what makes those things luxurious, right? And even like the best like AI on the planet, I can't put myself in a position to feel like that is something luxurious, because both of these things, facials and massages, for instance, are things that have already been automated to some degree. And it is just, it does not feel luxurious under those circumstances.
Part of what you're getting, part of the luxury of it is the human connection. Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. That makes sense.
Same thing with like manicures, pedicures, whatever else you can think of that makes me a luxurious bitch. Like, automation can't do that for me. It just won't.
I couldn't imagine a barbershop experience that didn't include the human connection to the barber, you know.
Well, I think part of what this calls to mind, though, is that there would be a lot more people who could, instead of having to go to work at the box factory or the insurance company, could spend their days developing their artisan craftsmanship in some field or another, being like doing like really getting really good at giving pedicures or haircuts or whatever it is, like grooming stuff or I don't know, what any sort of like field of like human caring where like people are taking care of each other creating art and you know, whatever creative things that human beings do. I don't think that those things get automated necessarily, at least, you know, first out of the gate. But people don't have to worry about, I can't pay my fucking bills doing this thing that I love and have passions for, so I have to go work down at the water treatment plant or whatever.
Well, sure. That's a partially automated comfort communism that you're talking about.
Okay, I might be done with partially automated comfort communism.
That's what the fuck. A slogan I can get behind.
There's
partially automated Baroque comfort communism. I'm into that.
So there's another element of this that I feel like would be tragic to not at least touch on, which is, we've sort of discussed some of the human cost of automation when it comes to creativity and feeling and ingenuity. But like, have you ever driven around the same area so much with like Google Maps that you've forgotten streets that you used to know? Right. So
yes.
Take that very banal, sort of observation about what technology can do to you in terms of your own capacities, and then magnify it to the scale of all intellectually laborious tasks that require memory and cataloging and calculation and quantification and extrapolation and so on. You on the one hand, you can look at like, I don't know how to can vegetables, and it used to be something that everybody used to have to do to get through the winter, and now you don't have to, so we don't know how. A lot of people don't know how to change a tire because you can always just, someone else will come do it, or you can learn how to do it on YouTube really quick. What do we do in the event of arriving upon a necessity on a social, like on the scale of society, when we have a society which is that broad loss of memory for how to do some of those life-saving tasks, or not even life-saving tasks, but just like, you know, maybe it is just about the ingenuity that we talk about we might lose, right? But you can really see how easy it would be to, like, and how tragic forgotten and lost knowledge can be, and what it might do to, like, our cognitive capacities.
We don't have to imagine. We just look at the Dark Ages.
Well, sure, right, you know? And you know, like a that's another another James Bridle references. He says a dark age isn't a time in which nothing is happening. It's a time in which the knowledge of what is happening isn't broadly understood and shared, and where things are forgotten. And his whole thesis is that we're living in a new dark age right now, and that's his example. Is all of what we already have forgotten as individuals and as a collective as a result of technological sophistication of information technology and storing and sharing. So in addition to concerns about the environment and all of the other things that we've raised, I just can't help but think it would have a really dampening effect on intellectual prowess, which is to me like the really exciting thing about the possibilities for our species after the abolition of exploitative wage labor and the production for profit is a notion of an engine of history, which is the clash of ideas.
I think that just anecdotally, two studies that I saw recently, one being that you don't retain information as well when you read it off of a screen as you do when you read it off of a page, and taking notes via laptop is nowhere near as effective as writing your notes down with a pen. And I think about how in college we were pushed to just adopt reading PDFs from your reader, adopt taking notes on your laptop because it's a lot faster. When I was in grad school, I had a professor who did not let us take notes by hand. He made us take notes on a laptop, which is problematic for lots of reasons. One of them being that not everyone can afford a fucking laptop. Yeah, I think that like there's sort of this fetishization of technological advance for its own sake that doesn't take into consideration the fact that we have very real mechanics within the human body and brain that allow for us to function the way we do and have done so for, you know, thousands of years, and that we are abruptly removing them, and we don't know what the results of that are going to be yet. And it turns out that we're making ourselves unable to remember things as well and to understand things that we read as well as a result of our rush headlong into wanting to have technology make things better. And I know that makes me sound like an old Luddite, but it's fucking real. This is not just me wondering. This is actually happening. This is,
well, you know, the impulses of the Luddites weren't wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just that history has had another plan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I'm the most eager to defend the whole book and the idea among the four of us.
It's because you live in the Pacific
as a revisionist.
Northwest.
Just because you're well,
I fucking hope. I would hope.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, fucking
no,
me
it's,
too.
It's just because Kevin is
so
revisionist.
The human anatomy evolved in a world where our ancestors did not wear shoes. Now, like everyone, I've worn shoes every day of my life, and because of that, I'm utterly dependent on having shoes on my feet in order to be able to, like, walk around in the world and not be terribly injured. I'm dependent on this piece of technology that is a part of my life because it's a part of my life. I think similarly, things like having to remember, how basic arithmetic. I now don't have to memorize arithmetic tables. I can just pull up a calculator and, get by with, I know how to count to 10, and that's about it.
I can count even higher than 10.
I also, I don't know my way around, but I mean, I've always been really bad with directions, but I'm terrible with, I don't know how to get anywhere because I always pull up my map. These are things that I'm able to outsource these functions onto technology that exists. And that doesn't, I don't think, for the most part, I don't think that inhibits me so much as it frees me up to focus on things that I would prefer to spend my physical and mental energy on. I think you can see a vision of how this can could function. It represented, I think what he's putting forward is a Star Trek future, right? Where you press a button and it gives you all food, any food that you want, food or drink in the entire known galaxy that you could possibly want. You just press a button and it just pops up in front of you. Nobody has to go, nobody has to know how to till the earth and grow a plant because you just press a button and there's food. Yet, on the show, you still have Captain Picard, you know, taking vacations to Earth to, like, garden and shit and like, grow some food or something. I think we could see that kind of a, you know, capacity of technology to free us from necessity rather than inhibit us from developing the things that we do want.
I like that Kevin is easily the least technologically inclined of everyone here and is the one who's most defending technology.
The laziest.
I mean, that actually makes a lot of sense, though. It's just like, oh, the technology makes my life easier. But it also sort of, it also helps make my argument that, like, if you don't know what to do with things, then when the technology doesn't make your life easier, your life sucks a lot.
I mean, I think the only thing I feel like is tricky is that, like, if we're creating our utopian society, is a question of, like, defining what the crappy jobs are, right? So I feel like when we're, I don't know, it verges on, like,
wiping people's butts in the hospital. I think that's one we can have a bidet robot take care of.
But. Yeah, I mean, this is going to open up a whole other can of worms that would be, like, very out of place anyway. Maybe it's not even worth addressing, but I'm just like, man, people can't think, like, elder care and taking care of disabled folks and, like, child care is, like, shitty stuff that we can or should automate. Parts of those things we can and should automate, but...
Thus the butt wiping component.
For sure, and, like, vomit cleaning.
I think that fundamentally Chris is right. Chris, when the first thing that he said at the beginning, I think it was to the point of the sort of environmental angle on the counter argument to this proposal, which is under the category of this isn't actually going to happen. This is a utopian vision that will never come to fruition. And he was specifically going to the environmental concerns aspect of that is that, like, by the time we actually get to the point of mining being capable of mining asteroids, we will have already destroyed the Earth, and it will be a fucking Mad Max hellscape, and that's kind of unfortunate. And so we can't wait for technology to save us. Unfortunately, so I think a major problem with the proposal that we're discussing, the luxury communism, whatever, automated luxury communism, is that it proposes a world or proposes a vision of the future that calls upon us to rely on the technology to save us, and so we just need to deal with, like, the fruits of the abundance that technology gives us, right? So we need to engage on a political... It does call on us to engage on a political project, and we can't just sort of, like, you know, wait for it to happen, right? It calls on... But the political project that it calls on us to engage in is one of implementing a redistribution of the goods and services created by this a superabundance from technology. But which I think maybe, Jason, where I definitely agree with your point, that means, you know, on a more conservative side, it would be universal basic income, a really big universal basic income. On a maybe a little more left wing side, it would be robust universal basic services. Neither of which I necessarily oppose, but if that is the angle that we're going toward to say that, like, this is how – these are the sort of reforms, the demands that we should be implementing right now, that steers us away from more more direct solution to the problem, which is universal employment, universal jobs programs, and democratized workplaces – and direct confrontation with capital and replacing, you know, with self-conscious workers' movements that are driving toward a vision of replacing capitalist ownership and of the means of production with worker collective worker ownership of the means of production. That's a different strategy. That's a different approach, and that's a different vision of the future that's being sought after.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 4545, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew. Nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 5555, your arms are hanging limp at your sides. Your legs got nothing to do. Some machine doing that for you. In the year 6565, ain't gonna need no husband, won't need no wife. You pick your son, pick your daughter too. From the bottom of a long glass tube, whoa, whoa. In the year 7510, if God's a-coming, he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 8510, God is gonna shake his mighty head. He'll either say, I'm pleased where man has been, or tear it down and start again. Whoa, whoa. In the year 9595, I'm kinda wondering if man is gonna be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing. Whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years. Man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year 2525,